HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Words No Bars Can Hold, Literacy Learning in Prison, by Deborah Appleman. Foreword by Jimmy Santiago Baca. Read by Virginia Woolf. Everybody is better than the worst they've ever done. Willie Earl Lloyd, Jr., convicted of murder at 18, freed after 23 years in prison. Education is Freedom, Paulo Freire. Foreword. I could mire the listener in statistics, data, and the graphs and charts and maps that prove education for prisoners works, but take my word for it, I am evidence of that. Once you start to listen to this book, Words No Bars Can Hold, you realize there's something larger at work here than just another testimony of someone's experience teaching creative writing and more in prison. Deborah Appleman leads us into the prison world and humanizes the prisoners, connects with them, unveils their sorrows and joys, works the environment until we often seem we're right beside her and can hear the breathing of the quiet cells, see the dreams of the men as they sleep, accompany them in their hopes and sorrows on their individual journeys to reclaim their humanity. It's much more, of course, and it works to bring full force the problems, the solutions, the alternating dynamics that have so often stymied the concerned citizen in the past. Deborah manages to balance out the pros and cons with rational insights that cannot be conveyed except through years of sacrifice and service. Her vocation and mission is not to righteously pose herself on a soapbox and rage about the wrongs and accuse. No. But to take us on a genuine search that leads to trial and error until she understands what unfolds as true growth, individual awareness, and a reckoning that leads to change. That's what this book does. It carries us through the various levels in prose that is clear and well thought out, showing how creative writing workshops work to salvage the human being's last remnants of self-esteem and allow the prisoner to give freedom another shot, and thus not return to prison. We arrive with her, but not in all the do-gooder blather of holier-than-thou Samaritan piety. Here, Deborah gets dirty, crawls in the trenches, exhausts her patience, and sometimes belabors to believe. And in the end, her perseverance and faith prove what no statistics and numbers can reflect, that through bulldogged commitment to a deep belief, seeing it through, one realizes that yes, indeed, creative writing does work to help prisoners find themselves, to improve their chances at making it on the outside. It encourages them to continue in their education, to believe again in themselves, to trust, to try to love and live again. There will always be the grim naysayers, the extreme conservatives that just see punishment as an end-all to every problem. Nothing, not all the proof in the world will serve to convince them otherwise. There are some, especially in this age of cynicism, that will never be moved by truth. But if you're open to creative positive change, then listen to Words No Bars Can Hold. This wonderful book proposes that education not only enhances the chances a prisoner will never come back to prison, education ensures, more than any other factor can, that after leaving prison, that person's life will be a productive contribution to society. Some progressive colleges like Bard do amazing work with educating prisoners and should be lauded and funded and serve as a model for other colleges. It's good for the students engaged in these programs, too. It helps the free and the imprisoned. What more could you ask for in pursuit of a more peaceful and judicial society? Providing a liberal arts education for prisoners is like breaking the seal of silence and opening a whole host of opportunities for men and women who have never had them, an effective way to usher in success, leave behind failure. There are tons of books and studies that prove it works, but rare is the one that takes us on such a profound journey. From the warden to guards to the prisoners and beyond, right down to the children of incarcerated men and women who say it works to improve their lives and relationships with their families and friends. Rather than neglect the problem of crime and pipeline from school to prison tragedy, Deborah Appleman launches into the opportunity to educate and help these prisoners grow and learn. She invites them to participate in the grand experiment of writing and reading and use literacy as a tool to become productive citizens. The alternative would be to decide to close themselves in their rooms and pout. But she stands there with the door open, beckoning them to engage with her. And they do. It's co-liberation. Her book seems to whisper, "We must go ahead with our dreams, and we will and do." Basic literacy obstacles are confronted, unscalable heights of emotional traumas challenged, until these students achieve the dream to read and write and restore and reclaim their humanity. She nails it in this book, how the classroom becomes a refuge of trust among the writers and poets in her writing class, how another level of humanity is reached through literature and writing. She gives us overviews of her teaching experience, personalizes the narrative with a life devoted to those incarcerated, of someone with a daunting and passionate commitment to prison reform through education. Deborah does more than advocate for education. She illustrates for listeners the amazing transformation the participant undergoes when determined to teach himself to read and write. She offers an extraordinary look at how humanity unfolds as fear is released, as trust is enhanced. We see each individual reaching out of his hostile environment to touch the world beyond with gentler, more peaceful hands and mind. She investigates ways to stop the destruction that happens when the pipeline from schools to prisons is carrying away our kids to one-way dead ends. The poems and writings are all a testament to the depth and passion and earnestness with which these participants embraced the education that allowed them to express their humanity. The blog posts between chapters take us on a journey from the inside of the author's heart and mind to the world that she enters every day, going from one place that is free into another place made of concrete and steel and sustained by fear and nightmares. And in part, it's the contrast she so aptly poses between these places, the college and the prison classroom, that makes this book so valuable. Appleman is a true warrior fighting the good fight, the valiant fight that makes a life worth living, gives it purpose, and during hard times protects it with the fabric of grace. Grace that can only arrive through great sacrifice and joy in one's work. I can't overstate how you need to listen to this book, carry it with you, pass it off to friends, take it to class, share it at dinner tables, listen to it at a coffee shop, quote from it. You'll be sharing in work that is profoundly important today. Prison education is the climate change nucleus of our social tragedy, and it can lead us toward the light. Unerringly, in ways that only someone who has given her life to writing programs in prison can, she invites us to come along and gives in a few hours of listening to what has taken her a lifetime to gather and offer us, an immeasurable gift of awareness and knowledge deeply needed today. Jimmy Santiago Baca. Prelude. Education. Life or death. He drove to our meeting. It seems mundane, a daily detail we take for granted, but for a formerly incarcerated person, it was a significant passage. The keys to the battered black Honda lay proudly on the restaurant table, an announcement of his complete liberation. "Willie gave me this car." Willie served time with Eli in prison and has been out long enough to have upgraded his beater. As Eli sat across from me, I noticed all the tokens of freedom he seemed to have amassed in such a short time. Well-polished dress shoes, a smartphone, an iPad, a fashion-forward watch, even a business card, I couldn't help but flash back to the baby-faced man in prison grays who sat in the very front of the first class I ever taught in a prison. It was an introduction to literature class, replete with a Norton anthology and literary criticism cards. Eli sat in front, next to Willie, devouring each literary text and its analysis. It was in that class that I first realized the power of teaching and learning behind bars for the incarcerated students and for the teacher. It was Eli, then serving a life sentence with seemingly no outdate, who pushed me to consider the pure, non-pragmatic, non-vocational value of learning for learning's sake. "What is the value of liberal education?" he once asked me. "To liberate," I replied automatically and unthinkingly, blushing at the insensitivity of the response to someone who had spent nearly 20 years behind bars and had a lifetime of incarceration stretching in front of him. "Yes," he said, "I knew you would say that. This learning will make us free." Back at the restaurant, his manners were almost exaggeratingly proper, eating fish and chips with a knife and fork, making up for all those hurriedly and unceremoniously ingested prison meals. We talked about the different building blocks that comprised his slowly reconstructed life. Good, work, plenty of successful networking, mastery of social media, and ambitious plans for the future. Not so good, a precarious marriage to someone who had befriended him in prison. When we began talking about the possibility of him visiting a school in the urban center of the city we now share to work with black adolescent males, his eyes lit up. "That's what it's all about. Education. How can I let them see what I learned without them having to go to prison to learn it? My life changed when I started learning. It shifted my paradigm. Educare. To bring out. To bring forth. That's what you taught me, and it made all the difference. I realized that there was something of value inside me, living beside the regret, the recriminations, the broken promises. I have to learn to do it, to do for them what you and others have done for me. We can work both ends of the pipeline, right? Move backwards so that the guys who are still inside can see what education can do for them. It ain't over. Maybe they can all get out someday. And then for those young brothers, let's try to capture them together with learning. Maybe they don't need to do time to learn my hard lessons, but we gotta do it. It's a matter of life and death." This was Eli, the autodidact, given a life sentence at 15, barely able to read and write. He became his own teacher and his own lawyer, and eventually was able to get his sentence overturned. I watched my student turning into a teacher, the incarcerated becoming free, and I began to realize that I will never do anything more important than be a teacher to men like Eli. It isn't what we teach that matters, it's who we teach that does. Chapter 1. A Tough Sell. Education and Incarceration. It's a tough sell, higher education, for the incarcerated. Despite the euphemistic use of the term correction, most penal institutions are in the business of punishment. It seems primal, almost biblical, this human inclination to want to punish. We extend that inclination into wanting to make sure that nothing good happens to people whom we deem to be bad. If education is good, then bad people shouldn't get it. Even tougher to sell than the general notion of education is the idea of liberal arts education for the incarcerated. Vocational training, welding, carpentry, computer programming, etc., makes sense to provide future job opportunities to those who will eventually be released. But general liberal education with no real-world value, especially for those serving life sentences? It's a tough sell indeed, but it's what I'm selling. This book focuses on the potential role of liberal arts education for the incarcerated and on the ways in which post-secondary education in general and creative writing opportunities in particular can help reframe the personal narratives of the incarcerated especially for those serving life sentences. It will also consider the school-to-prison pipeline, or nexus, from the sobering perspective of the end of the pipeline, since most of the students with whom I have worked are serving life sentences in a state that no longer offers parole. In the 21st century, the United States incarcerates more of its citizens than any other country. On any given day, more than one in every 100 adults are in jail or prison. Although there were an estimated 6,899,000 people, 2.8% of American adults, within adult correction systems in 2013, the incarcerated remain nearly invisible to most of society. As Alexander argues, incarceration has become the new caste system in the United States. Despite incontrovertible evidence of the powerful effects of education on recidivism, education programs in prison have diminished or disappeared as a result of restrictions on funding such as Pell Grants and the chilling effects of tough-on-crime legislation. Across the country, funding has dried up for prison programs, especially those located in high or maximum security prisons. As Martin explains, the tough-on-crime era of the 1970s and after ushered in a host of measures that supported the framework of a harsher, more punitive approach to prisoners. Mandatory minimum sentencing, three strikes and you're out sentencing laws, juveniles being tried as adults, all of these were part of the trend. Amid all this, the defunding of education programs for prisoners was a less noticed but related change. Offerings in prisons have dwindled to just a handful of largely technical courses. Libraries have become sparse and outdated. Technology is used only sparingly and is compromised by constant surveillance and worries of security breaches. Many potential students are ineligible for the classes they are so eager to take because of their status as violent offenders. In other words, those who are most likely to benefit from the positive outcomes of post-secondary education are prevented from taking part in it. In Unlocking Potential, Results of a National Survey of Post-Secondary Education in State Prisons, a report from the Institute for Higher Education Policy, the authors found that, although research has shown a link between educating prisoners and reduced rates of recidivism, many inmates have struggled to pay for college since President Bill Clinton barred inmates from receiving Pell Grants in 1994. Some private colleges have joined with nearby prisons to offer free, for-credit courses to inmates, but those individual partnerships, while often successful in reducing recidivism on a small scale, don't represent the educational opportunities available to most inmates. To be sure, there are a few notable exceptions to this dire portrait of prison education programs. Both Bard College and Grinnell College offer prison programs that present liberal arts behind bars. Bard College has an extensive program that works with five New York prisons. While these two programs have clearly animated the potential of offering liberal arts to the incarcerated, they exist as isolated beacons of light in an otherwise dark landscape of missed opportunities. So what can liberal arts education do for the incarcerated? Why should this particular kind of education, often associated with elite colleges and students of privilege, be offered to the incarcerated? I intend to answer these questions in my book. Harris describes a liberal arts education as one that teaches individuals how to think, how to learn, how to make sense of the world around them, how to understand the relationship between old knowledge and new knowledge, and how to generate creativity. He writes, "The diverse body of knowledge you will gain from a liberal arts education, together with the tools of examination and analysis that you will learn to use, will enable you to develop your own opinions, attitudes, values, and beliefs based not upon the authority of parents, peers, or professors, and not upon ignorance, whim, or prejudice, but upon your own worthy apprehension, examination, and evaluation of argument and evidence. A thorough knowledge of a wide range of events, philosophies, procedures, and possibilities makes the phenomena of life appear coherent and understandable, No longer will unexpected or strange things be merely dazzling or confusing. Brown University also delineates some important results of liberal arts education, including enhancing communication skills such as writing and speaking, understanding differences among cultures, evaluating human behavior, embracing diversity, learning what it means to study the past, collaborating fully, experiencing scientific inquiry, developing a facility with symbolic languages, expanding reading skills, enhancing aesthetic sensibility, and applying what one has learned. These are broad intellectual goals, to be sure, but goals that are relevant for the incarcerated as well. As Nixon writes, education should also be considered on its own merit. Put simply, education is not just a means to myriad positive ends, but an end unto itself. Education on its own is worth pursuing, worth having, and worth supporting. Although it may seem counterintuitive, liberal arts education is particularly well suited to the incarcerated, especially those who are serving very long sentences. The lack of specific vocational focus, sometimes viewed as a shortcoming for those on the outside, is actually advantageous for those who are drawn to experiences whose value is not tied to vocational training. For many of the incarcerated, these programs provide a second chance to avail themselves of the value of education, a value that they may not have previously experienced. Many prisoners are likely to have poor self-confidence and negative attitudes about education because they viewed their early experiences as being negative. While many of the incarcerated with whom I have worked seem to have had ambivalent feelings about education on the outside, it becomes a cherished experience for most on the inside. At a panel featuring Grinnell's Liberal Arts in Prison program, a recently released former student spoke enthusiastically about what the liberal arts had done for him. "Liberal arts changed me to the core. The liberal arts teach you how to think. Vocational education may teach you how to perform a job, but liberal arts education teaches you about yourself." Another member of the panel said, "The outside world falls away when you're institutionalized. The world outside of prison becomes an abstract idea. Liberal arts education makes that world come back to you. As you grapple with ideas, you're grappling with the world." One important element of liberal arts education is the ability to express one's ideas and learning through writing, both expository and creative. While literacy researchers in the fields of composition, creative writing, reading and literature, and adult education have rightfully expanded their focus to include many kinds of diverse learners, little attention has historically been paid to the literacy learning of the incarcerated. While the courses that I have taught have included both kinds of writing, my focus has been more weighted to creative writing. Recently, there's been a renewal of interest in how the teaching of creative writing might provide important opportunities for the incarcerated. Rogers focuses on the pedagogical considerations relevant to teaching creative writing to the incarcerated. PMLA published a suite of articles on in-prison education, including studies about the impact of literature on the lives of the incarcerated, the literary accomplishments of the incarcerated, productions of Shakespeare by and for offenders at correctional facilities in Wisconsin and Massachusetts, and the appropriateness of higher education within prison settings. Still, opportunities for creative writing in prison, especially prisoner-sponsored programs, are rare. More rarely still have prison efforts been considered in the context of liberal arts education as a whole. In particular, the pedagogy of creative writing, with its emphasis on identity construction and narration, seems to provide an impetus for innovation as the incarcerated writers reshaped their personal narratives and decided to claim personal power through their writing to the degree that they were able to do so. They formed a collective to publish a book, held group sessions for aspiring writers, secured more creative writing opportunities for fellow prisoners, and created a restorative justice program that donated proceeds from their book to causes of healing and reparation. According to correctional officials, the writers who participated in the education program were less likely to engage in behavior warranting reprimand in the cell blocks, and they improved their attendance at other prison programs as well. Several joined the staff of the prison newspaper, The Prison Mirror, which happens to be the oldest-running prison newspaper in the United States. This offers some evidence that the pedagogy of creative writing, with its emphasis on identity construction and narration, seems to provide opportunities for self-reflection as well as powerful clues to where the life courses of these incarcerated students might have been altered. Through narrative and oral history, prisoners explore and interrogate their own sense of identity. Through successful literacy learning experiences, incarcerated learners are able to readjust their sense of themselves as writers and readers with literate lives. Finally, recent research reveals that the more education a prisoner has when he is released, the less likely he or she is to reoffend. On the other hand, there were several writers who, despite their efforts in the classes, continued to have disciplinary and personal issues within the prison. Their experiences remind us to resist the overly romantic notion that literacy programs can become a panacea for the incarcerated. Words are powerful, but not magical, and these writers and their continued struggle remind us of the limits of these efforts. Liberal education does not allow the incarcerated, or their teachers for that matter, to transcend the persistent social, educational, and economic problems. Without undercutting the power of those literacy narratives that are produced and celebrated, the book calls for a more realistic frame through which to view literacy education in prison. Thus far, my work offers some evidence that, through successful literacy learning experiences, most incarcerated learners readjust their stance within the context of the prison, begin to seek advanced degrees, and sometimes even initiate contact with victims or their victims' families through the Restorative Justice Program. This program is designed to help the incarcerated come to terms with their crimes by making them accountable to their victims in a variety of ways. They write apology letters that are stored until the victim's family requests them. Occasionally, as was the case for two of my students, they actually meet face-to-face with the victim's family. In some ways, these incarcerated students attempt to write themselves back into a society that has erased their lived histories. The student work presented in this book will demonstrate the transformative power of education to promote self-efficacy and literacy in even the most dehumanizing of circumstances. Finally, as educators become aware that youth caught up in school disciplinary webs are more likely to be retained in grades, pushed out of school, commit a crime, and/or end up incarcerated as adults, this book seeks to offer some insight from the narratives of those who are caught in the school-to-prison pipeline. The rest of the book is organized in the following way. Each chapter is followed by an excerpt from a blog I kept while teaching full-time at the prison during a sabbatical. The entries are not presented in chronological order, but rather by the resonance they have to the chapters they follow. Chapter 2, The Geography of Incarceration, The Glass Bubble in the Big House. This chapter describes the context of the education program at the prison where I teach. It contrasts the Shawshank grittiness of the rest of the prison with the physical and psychological oasis that the classroom provides. Chapter 3, Of Friere and Frost, Reading the World Behind Bars. In this chapter, I describe the teaching and learning dynamic of the classes I taught, as well as the tutoring program, where educated prisoners tutor others for basic literacy and GED preparation. Chapter 4, No Hugs for Thugs, Surveillance and Control. The limits and controls imposed by the Department of Corrections, DOC, hold teachers hostage as well as students. This chapter explores the constraints on teaching and learning and provides an analysis of why such limits exist. Chapter 5, I Will Write Myself Out of Prison, Rewriting the Self. This chapter focuses on the ways in which the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?